Finance and Policy Committee to order. The first agenda item is to take the roll. Ms. Hansen, can you proceed to take the roll, please?
Of course. Chair Schultz?
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner?
Present.
Reed Albright?
Present.
Representative Bolden?
Present.
Representative Burkle?
Present.
Representative Fisher?
Fisher, present.
Thank you. Representative Frederick?
Present.
Representative Hansen?
Present.
Representative Keel?
Present.
Representative Liebling?
Present.
Representative Mueller?
Present.
Representative Knorr?
Present.
Thank you. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, present.
Representative Pearson? Representative Pinto?
Present.
Representative Rasmussen?
Present.
Representative Robbins? Representative Sandel?
Present.
Thank you. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, present.
Thank you, members.
Okay, we have a quorum. So let's see. Representative Keel, would you like to move the minutes from January 27th?
Yes, I would move the minutes from January 27th.
Thank you. So Representative Keel moves approval of the minutes for January 27th, 2021. Any discussion or corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, please unmute yourself. So all in favor of approving the minutes, say aye. Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, so the minutes from January 27th, 2021 are approved. So today we have a full agenda. We have the Commissioner Harpstead. She will be presenting along with her team the governor's budget proposal. I know you are all eager to hear about the budget proposal for human services. So I will let her and her team present the budget proposal, and I believe they have a slide deck. All of the material and the change sheets were sent out by Doug Berg on Tuesday. So those should be in your inbox. If you cannot locate those, let us know and we'll resend that information. And let's see who I think we have Commissioner Harpstead on the call with us. There she is. So we will reserve questions until the end of the presentation. So please raise your hand towards the end and we will start a list. So welcome to the committee, Commissioner Harpstead. Please proceed and then introduce you. I know you have a lot of people here, so just please introduce others if they need to take parts of the presentation.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. We'll introduce people as we go through the presentation. I'm pleased this morning to be able to present to you the human services portion of the governor's COVID-19 recovery budget. The Department of Human Services mission is working with many others. We help people meet their basic needs so they can live in dignity and achieve their highest potential. This is what we call our Minnesota baseline. Going into our budget proposal exercise, we made note that Minnesota ranks first nationally in delivering services for older adults and people with disabilities, according to three organizations in 2020. We ranked third nationally in healthcare access, quality, and outcomes, according to the Commonwealth Fund in 2019, and seventh nationally for overall health, according to America's Health Rankings in 2019. And we have all heard that Minnesota ranks almost last in the nation in racial equity. The Walz-Flanagan administration pledges that Minnesota should be the number one place for children to grow. We also made note as we went into our budget exercise that Minnesotans age 30 plus are 15% Black, Indigenous, and people of color, and Minnesotans under 30 are 30% Black, Indigenous, and people of color. This shows you DHS's forecasted programs, projected expenditures in fiscal 20. You can see the very long bar at the top, which is our Minnesota, our Medicaid long-term care and home and community-based services for older adults and people with disabilities. If you look at the third bar, you see the rest of our services for older adults and people with disabilities. And if you add those two bars together, you can see how much of our total forecasted programs they represent. Another way to look at it is over the last 8 years, you can see the increase and the size of each of these budgets. The top line is our long-term care facilities for older adults, by far the largest expenditure in our Medicaid program and the fastest growing at 75% over these years. The next line shows our home and community-based waivers for people with disabilities and a few of older adults. And you can see that that is our second largest expenditure and has grown 23%. The next line is elderly and disabled basic care, still older adults, people with disabilities, and our second fastest growing budget. And then you can see the budget for families at the bottom. Looking at our enrollment in our services, if you look at the top bar, you see Minnesota's overall population disaggregated by race. You can see then that our skilled nursing facilities and assisted living facilities, 94% white, and our group homes for people with disabilities, 87% white people served, that is. And then our day services for people with disabilities more closely reflect the population of the state of Minnesota. And it only when you get to personal care attendant services for people with disabilities do you begin to see a disproportional share of people of color. On the other end of the spectrum, this is, again, the same bar at the top, Minnesota's overall population. The next one is our public health program enrollment. The next is our SNAP food security enrollment, and then MFIP. And here you can see that the Hispanic Latinx population is twice its proportional share of the Minnesota population enrolled in MFIP. In our the Black Minnesotans are five times their proportional share enrolled in MFIP, and American Indians nine times their proportional share of Minnesota enrolled in MFIP. I've said this many times, I think I said this to you a couple of weeks ago, that my greatest learning in my first year as commissioner is that if I don't proactively reach out to BIPOC, LGBTQIA+, and rural communities, the people I will hear from are the larger, more well-resourced organizations who can afford the lobbyists, professional associations, and public relations campaigns, where its resources beget more resources. And at the Department of Human Services, we have the responsibility to make our $17 billion in resources available to support all Minnesotans. So here are some of the principles we went into our budget process with. Housing first for all. It's very hard to help you, yourself, or family, make ends meet and get on with life on your own without housing. The second would be whole family support and family preservation. Childcare support, which has been vital to supporting our economy as well as supporting individual families through COVID. We are committed to people with disabilities living, learning, working, and enjoying life in integrated settings in their own communities. And simplified and equitable access to home and community-based services for older adults and people with disabilities. We've long since known that baby boomers are not able to live in these congregate care settings, nursing homes, to living, and group homes. And after reading about how those have fared during COVID, we think they are less likely to be interested in living in these congregate care settings. And now that we have developed services in our communities like Amazon and Lyft, et cetera, we are eager to help support stronger home services for these populations. And of course, DHS always has to pay attention to federal compliance and process control. In case you were wondering, whatever happened to the Blue Ribbon Commission on Health and Human Services, we did indeed achieve the goal of identifying $100 million in cost-saving proposals just in time for this session. We could not tackle the health transformation strategies due to our partners at the Department of Health being taken away by COVID, and we didn't fully examine health equity and administrative proposals. But enabled saving strategies that were included in the governor's budget, three for using state purchase power to reduce cost, two for more effective utilization of disabilities, one for allowing for more effective managed care across providers, one for further reducing fraud state-funded services, for a total of $1.4 million of the $100 million in identified savings. We've agreed with the governor's office that other thoughtful policy improvements best left until after the market recovers and are not included in the governor's budget, leaving $38.6 million to come out of the reserve. So overall, what you'll see in our budget proposals, in our savings proposals, are to protect children and family services from cuts that would cause even greater disparity. Savings proposals for little used or no longer needed funding. Savings proposals that impact provider sectors least hard hit by COVID. And again, deferring other thoughtful policy strategies in long-term care until the market recovers. And we had to make difficult choices in order to hit a target. We have included a group of proposals. First, meeting our responsibility to appropriately fund services while maintaining safer treatment facilities for 1,000 Minnesotans in our direct care and treatment. Investing in areas that stand back up a more equitable economy. You'll see higher wages for PCAs, investment in pathways out of homelessness, investment in family preservation and equitable access to childcare, improving MFIP functionality and a one-time increase to support employment, addressing healthcare disparities in birth outcomes and telemedicine. And we also have been eager to honor our tribal consultations and our county collaboration. We've had an unprecedented opportunity to have budget conversations this fall with our tribes and our counties, allowing us to begin to really think like a seamless state-funded county and tribal administered system. In the end, we have expenditure proposals of $184.2 million to the general fund, with a reduction proposals of $137 million. $61.3 million of those are Blue Ribbon Commission proposals already accounted for in the biennium budget, and $75.7 million are non-Blue Ribbon Commission proposals. The general fund impact, then, is a net investment of $108.5 million. We return $2.8 million in savings to the Healthcare Access Fund and invest $71.4 million out of the TANF Fund. I have been told by many people since I became commissioner that in a budget deficit session, everyone comes after human services. It has been my experience in living in Minnesota now for 40 years that it's in an economic downturn, Minnesotans rally around their neighbors and support human services. Now Minnesota has been through a once in a lifetime pandemic and an economic downturn, and I hope that Minnesotans will choose to offer support to our neighbors who most need it coming out of COVID. I also presented to this committee 2 weeks ago we've done at DHS over the past year to strengthen process controls after headlines in 2019. Taking a big whack at our administrative budget would put that progress at risk. And now I'd like to turn over to our assistant commissioner for, I'm going to tell you about the DCT operating adjustment first. Again, we have a DCT deficit running coming up for the biennium 22 and 23 of $53.3 million. We were able to reduce and deal with the deficit thanks to legislative support in 21, but we still have a deficit for the next couple of biennium. And then finally, we have opened a new child and adolescent behavioral health hospital in Willmar. And we are asking the counties to pay their share of the cost of that service after clients there are no longer needing hospital level of care, but are still there. And now I'm going to turn us over to our Assistant Commissioner for Community Supports, Gertrude Mutembo-Matasa. Gertrude.
Thank you, Commissioner. Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to be here. I'll dive right in.
Could you please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed? Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. My name is Gertrude Mutembo-Matasa. I am the Assistant Commissioner for Community Supports at DHS. Again, thank you for the opportunity to be here. Personal care assistants, also known as PCAs, provide critical services to older adults and people with disabilities in their own homes. This service is important because it increases options for individuals who may not prefer congregate settings. This proposal makes significant investments in the PCA program. The increases in this proposal impact all PCA rates, not just union-represented employees. So the state and SEIU completed negotiations for a new contract just this month, January of 2021, as the current contract expires in June of this year. This proposal funds contractual obligations for fiscal year 22 and 23 based on the terms of the new contract. This proposal increases the wage floor from $13.25 to $14.40 starting in October of 21. Another increase scheduled for July of 22 from $14.40 to $15.25. Excuse me. We would also see an increase in paid time off accrual rates by 1 hour for every 30 hours worked, an increase in paid holidays, as well as $1 million in grants for training stipends for individual providers who have completed designated voluntary trainings. Next slide, please. And onto homelessness. Homelessness is an ongoing crisis that impacts communities across our state. And the pandemic has definitely worsened the crisis. So with this proposal, we're seeing an increase in the base funding for the state's emergency services program in the amount of $10 million for the biennium, or $5 million per year. And this investment would provide more funding for emergency shelters, which are critical as we're trying to tackle this issue of homelessness. It also establishes base funding for the homeless management information system at $1 million for the biennium. The homeless management information system, commonly known as HMIS, is really important because it is used to collect client level data on the provision of housing services to individuals who are currently experiencing homelessness and individuals who are at risk for homelessness. And it also increases funding for the Community Living Infrastructure Grant Program. And this grant provides funding for counties and tribes to help them integrate housing services into their human services work. And that investment would be $10 million for the biennium. Next slide, please. The next proposal is tribal cost-neutral housing support. The state's housing support program helps to pay for room and board costs for adults with low income who are 65 years or older, or who have a disability that prevents them from earning enough to support themselves. Housing support recipients reside in authorized settings, and these settings are authorized by counties and tribes, and they receive services from vendors that are approved by the counties or the tribes. So this proposal is cost neutral. It simply clarifies that tribes have the same administrative option as counties to request to change the funding mechanism, really from individual payments issued through MAXIS to a cost-neutral direct allocation that will be passed through the tribe. It is important to note that this proposal does not expand eligibility for individuals or vendors of housing support. It simply really just clarifies that tribes are eligible administrators of housing supports for eligible individuals in eligible settings, and therefore tribes should have the same administrative flexibility as counties to administer the housing support program in ways that are more efficient. Okay. Our next proposal is case management redesign. The redesign of Medicaid-funded case management services is a long-standing goal of the Minnesota Legislature, DHS, counties, tribes, and stakeholders alike. The overarching goal of the case management redesign initiative is really to improve the overall health and well-being of people by improving the quality of and access to Medicaid case management services. This $612,000 investment proposed here will be used to put state rates and payment for targeted case management services in compliance with federal requirements. And it will also help to set the stage for future improvements. So in addition to achieving federal compliance, this proposal also supports Minnesota tribes in the development of a tribal targeted case management benefit. Next slide, please. Our next proposal is mental health uniform service standards. So here in Minnesota, we have a long history of establishing an innovative range of community-based mental health services to meet the needs of our communities. The services provide hope and recovery for families and individuals who are impacted by mental illness. But as we have continued to innovate over time, the standards that guide our range of mental health care services have become increasingly complex. Many providers and stakeholders have raised significant concerns about the prescriptiveness and complexity of our regulations. So for example, under current law, some mental health care services are licensed, some are certified, and some have no clear oversight at all. So this means that various areas of DHS, including provider enrollment and the behavioral health and licensing divisions, are conducting similar reviews of the same providers, often at different times. So this proposal invests in the creation of a common core of standards that apply to all mental health care programs and really begins to transition the regulatory structure of our mental health care system to a unified licensing structure. Next slide, please. Our substance use disorder reform package is really a really an important one at this point, as over the past decade, our knowledge and attitudes about substance use disorders have shifted. We know that scientific research confirms that substance use disorders are a chronic medical condition involving complex interactions between brain chemistry, genetics, the environmental lived experience. This shift has led to changes in treatment for substance use disorders, notably a shift to evidence-based and person-centered models. The Department of Human Services has worked with individuals, providers, counties, and other stakeholders to modernize our substance use disorder system. And this proposal really builds on some of the recent reforms to improve quality of services, as well as payment integrity. So with this proposal, we would require residential SUD providers serving people on public healthcare programs to enroll as participants in the state's SUD system reform project. By so doing, our SUD providers, by enrolling SUD providers in the 1115 demonstration, this will allow Minnesota to access additional federal revenue, which will in turn be used to fund additional SUD treatment initiatives. This proposal would also transition historic residential treatment rates into the established SUD system reform project enhanced rate. So providers in this SUD 1115 project are eligible for a rate increase of 15% for residential services and an increase of 10% for non-residential services. The proposal would also reduce daily billable hours for non-residential SUD treatment, reducing those hours from 17 hours per day to 6 hours per day. And this reduction came about because we learned that only a few programs actually currently provide this intensity of service. The proposal also modifies the payment structure for opioid treatment program services. The proposal seeks to respond to the OLA recommendations by requiring the Department of Human Services to develop a payment methodology, ensuring appropriate payment reimbursement for services provided at opioid treatment programs. It will also align opioid treatment program reimbursement rates with other outpatient programs, and this will incentivize the provision of therapy in addition to the use of medications. Next slide, please. Our next proposal is a waiver reimagine. Over 57,000 Minnesotans with disabilities live, work, and engage in their communities with support from home and community-based waiver services. This proposal continues the transformation of the disability waiver system to promote equitable distribution of resources, program sustainability, and increased choice for Minnesotans with disabilities who use waiver services. It implements the second phase of Waiver Reimagine, which is a strategic redesign of the disability waiver service system. And that redesign really modernizes and streamlines administrative management of the system. Currently, there are four disability waivers: brain injury, community alternative care, community access for disability inclusion, and disability developmental disabilities, commonly known as BI, CAG, CADI, and DD. While each of these programs provide critical supports, people with disabilities and stakeholders agree that the disability waiver system is complex to navigate, and really we want it to be easier to understand. This proposal will consolidate the four disability waivers into a two waiver structure, one waiver that serves people living independently or at home with family, and one waiver that serves people living in residential settings. The plan allocates resources using an individual budget that links a person's needs to a range of service plan costs. This proposal has a cost of $1.7 million in the fiscal year 22-23 biennium and a net savings of about $7.4 million in the fiscal year 2024-25 period. Next slide, please. So our next proposals, a couple proposals related to older adults and people with disabilities. The first one is related to acuity-based customized living rates and closing the corporate foster care licensure loophole. The governor is proposing that effective January 1st of 2022, that we would align access to customized living services with a person's assessed support needs. And secondly, to limit the growth of customized living settings that serve four or fewer people. These changes would impact customized living services offered on the Community Access for Disability Inclusion, the CADI, and brain injury BI waivers. And these modifications will ensure that authorized services are consistent with person-centered assessments that will also support proper licensure for four-person residential settings. And this proposal will result in a $2.3 million savings for fiscal year 22-23, which is a 0.7 decrease of the customized living state general fund base within the disability service program. The next one is rate reform for remote service provision. This proposal adjusts disability waiver rate system rates for some day unit-based with programming and unit-based without programming services when the services are delivered remotely. These changes align with known cost component factors that would not pertain to a remote service delivery model. Specifically, this proposal reduces the client and programming support component value, the service facility component value, and the program support component value for affected services. And now I will turn it over to my colleague, Lisa Bailey.
Welcome. Assistant Commissioner, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Lisa Bailey. I'm the Acting Assistant Commissioner for Children and Families, and I'm pleased to be here today to tell you about a few of the programs the governor is proposing that directly impact children and families. The first one is the governor recommends investing $47.5 million from the Child Care Development Fund and $12,000 from the General Fund in the fiscal year 2020-23 biennium for changes to the Child Care Assistance Program, or CCAP, to update the maximum rates paid to child care providers. This change will bring the Child Care Assistance Program into compliance with the federal Child Care and Development Block Grant regulations. And with this change, this would bring the maximum rate paid to the child providers to 30% of market rate. We know that when payment rates are too low, providers are less likely to serve families receiving child care assistance. And those providers who do choose to continue serving families accept low payment rates, often struggle to offer quality care and attract and retain good staff and maintain their facilities. We believe that this proposal will go a long way towards alleviating that problem. Next slide, please. The governor is also proposing a one-time investment in the MFIP, or Minnesota Family Investment Program. As everyone knows, the MFIP provides income support and employment services to families with children in deep poverty. This proposal would provide that one-time payment for up to $750 for families who participate in MFIP to help address significant challenges specifically incurred during the COVID-19 pandemic. And this would be paid for with $24.2 million out of the TANF investment fund. We know that the vast majority of parents who turned to MFIP had recently lost a job and are frequently concentrated in hotel, restaurant, retail, low-wage healthcare occupations. We know that was true before the pandemic. These are the families now most impacted by the economic fallout of the pandemic. We also know that the number of families that have turned to MFIP has increased by more than 5,000 since March of 2020. Next slide, please. The governor is also proposing an economic assistance cash program proposal. Complex public assistance policies divert our precious county staff time, setting the stage for errors and creating even more stress for people in crisis who have turned to assistance. The fact that these policies then differ from program to program adds to that complexity and the possibility of confusion and errors. This proposal would simplify the process of determining benefits, supporting work by reducing the heavy paperwork burden put on recipients, and especially it would also reduce the amount, the workload and time spent by county workers. This would prepare for a more efficient, less expensive modernization of our IT system used to determine eligibility, which is one of our big goals. As I said, these simplifications will result in less county worker time spent administering benefits. As an idea of how much paperwork can add to a county's financial burden, in 2018, counties spent $128 per case per month to administer MFIP and $42 per case per month to administer GA, compared to $37 to administer MFIP, to administer SNAP. These simplifications will reduce those costs and reduce stress on recipients, leaving more time for applying for jobs instead of applying for benefits. This proposal uses $4.1 million in this biennium and $78.7 million in the next biennium, with that being offset by a $19.1 million one-time TANF reserve investment. Next slide, please. The Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA, is a federal law that was passed in 1978 to recognize and honor the sovereignty of tribal nations and preserve Indian families. Minnesota, unfortunately, leads the nation in disproportionality for American Indian children in the child welfare system. According to the Children's Bureau data, American Indian children are 17 times more likely than white children in Minnesota to experience foster care. Unfortunately, those rates of removal have continued to worsen in recent years. We know that maintaining family and cultural connections is essential to the well-being of American Indian children who do need to enter the child protection system. We have conducted internally at DHS ICWA reviews, and these demonstrate that enhanced training on American Indian family preservation is needed for county child welfare workers and supervisors to reduce the disproportionate number of those American Indian families involved in the child welfare system in Minnesota. So this program will create a training program and an ICWA certification in partnership with U of M Duluth. This would be with an investment of $2.1 million for each of the next two bienniums. $2.0 million in 2022-23 and $2.1 million in 2024-25. This proposal has been developed over some time with a significant tribal support and partnership. Next slide, please. The governor is also proposing to support the continued implementation of the Family First Prevention Services Act. This act is required to be implemented by October 1st of 2021. So this proposal would support those implementation needs in order to meet that federal deadline and to allow time for adequate preparation for future compliance and to supporting and building capacity for appropriate services for children and families. The state would ensure that those facilities that are required to meet new standards would have that capacity to meet the standards and have time for DHS review and approving new certifications. This body did approve legislation in 2019 and 2020, which provided resources that we're very grateful for, and the statutory changes needed that to begin developing that state infrastructure regarding residential services. This proposal would continue to prepare the state for implementation, reduce the risk of disruption to children and families, and to funds flowing to the counties. This proposal adds 11 additional staff for the Child Safety and Permanency Unit, the Background Studies Area, and Licensing Division to ensure that Minnesota continues to be compliant with federal law. And with that, I am pleased to turn it over to my colleague, Kalani Moti.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Bailey. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kulani Moti, and I serve as the Inspector General here at DHS. And I appreciate the opportunity to go over the proposals in our licensing and background studies area, as well as federal compliance. The first proposal today is going to be adding a set of providers to the background studies requirement. And these are for the EIDBI providers. And the EIDBI is the Early Intensive Development Behavioral Intervention Services that are provided as a medical assistance or an MA benefit. These services provide medically necessary treatment to people under the age of 21 with autism spectrum disorder and related conditions. This proposal would add or include these providers that offer these services to have them complete a background studies. And this would allow or would improve the protections for children and youth who receive the services by having them complete the background studies. The next proposal that I would like to discuss or go over is the background studies transition to fee schedule. The background studies division is responsible for performing statutorily required background studies checks for people who provide services to children and vulnerable adults in licensed and unlicensed settings. This is a fee-for-service enterprise, and the background studies fees are set in statutes and have mostly remained unchanged since 2005 or when a fee has been established. The division's current funding model relies on these fees to support the operation and administration and to cover all expenses and costs associated with the checks. Over the years, the cost associated with background studies has significantly outgrown the revenue provided by the current fixed fee schedule. This proposal would remove the background studies fees from statute and implement the fee schedule. It would allow DHS to actually be able to cover the cost of a background study. By doing this, it would ensure that DHS would be able to meet the increased demand for studies, respond effectively to the increasing complexity of studies, avoid and remedy any study backlogs, and to address the escalating costs, which are often paid to third parties to conduct various criminal history and registry searches. And for providers and employees, it would allow DHS to begin to standardize studies, which would increase the possibility of studies being able to be transferred between employers. The next proposal I'd like to discuss is our withdrawal management license fee. So the withdrawal management program licensing requirements were enacted in 2015 to provide a higher level of medical services to assist clients with more acute withdrawal symptoms and to allow Minnesota to add withdrawal management services to the Medicaid benefit set. At that time, an annual license fee was not established with the licensing standards, as the intention was for the withdrawal management program license to replace the detoxification program license. And once that would occur, the annual license fee would be established. However, due to the differences between the two types of programs of the services provided, the intensity of the services provided, the admission eligibility requirements, the funding sources, the department now allows programs to be licensed as a detox program, a withdrawal management program, or to be dually licensed as both. Under this proposal, the annual license fees will be established according to the license capacity of the program and will be based on the current fees required in our detox program. If a withdrawal management program is duly licensed as both a detox program and a withdrawal management program, only one fee would be assessed, and it would be the detox program annual license fee. Next slide. So now I'd like to go over the federal compliance proposals, and these are proposals that would be needed in order to ensure that Minnesota and DHS remain in compliance with federal regulations. So the first one is the federal compliance for the North Star Care for Children. In July of 2019, DHS received notice from the federal government that the Minnesota's North Star Adoption Assistance Statutes were out of compliance with federal law. So this proposal amends the Minnesota statutes to eliminate the requirement that DHS automatically offset North Star Adoption Assistance and North Star Kinship Assistance Program payments. It would also remove the requirement that the negotiation process include consideration of a child's income and resources. These changes would place Minnesota statutes in compliance with federal law. The next proposal is addressing the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or otherwise known as SNAP, payment error rate. Minnesota's SNAP payment error rate for fiscal year 2019 was 9.78%, and that was triggering a requirement for a corrective action plan and putting Minnesota in a first-year liability status with the USDA, our federal oversight rights agency. The national threshold is 6%. First-year liability status is a warning with no fiscal penalty, but if the error rate is too high in federal fiscal year 2020, Minnesota would be paying a penalty that must be passed on to local counties and tribes according to state law. And following with the USDA recommendations, this proposal would provide funding for 5 FTEs to improve training, policy development and implementation, quality control, IT operations, and management evaluation. This proposal would also fund updates to the MAXIS eligibility system requested by counties and tribal human service agencies. The next federal compliance proposal that we have is for our background studies area. I mean, DHS needs to make these two changes to the background study statutes in order to come into compliance of a couple of federal regulations. The first change will ensure DHS can continue to receive the necessary data about background study subjects from the FBI. And the second change will ensure that DHS is in compliance with the federal Child Care and Development Block Grant requirements and continue to receive funding under that program without penalty. The proposals will make changes to Minnesota statutes to ensure that the department has the appropriate authority to continue to submit and receive FBI data and to make determinations for background studies. And the last federal compliance proposal is also again with our background studies area. And it's adding in our new background studies partners. In 2019, the legislature required the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board, otherwise known as PELSB, to contract with DHS to conduct background studies for first-time teaching license applicants. During the policy implementation, it was noticed and reviewed by the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, or BCA, about concerns about DHS's authority and statute to conduct background studies for PELSB. Upon consultation and review by the FBI, it was determined that we needed to make some changes and updates to the statute in order to meet the requirements of federal rules and regulations and statutes. So in order to be able to do that, we would need to make the necessary changes. Also, DHS has been completing background studies for MNSHR for various positions through the MNSHR as the navigators, our in-person assisters, and consumer assistant partners through a contractual relationship. MNSHR must be added to our state statute in order to clarify some roles and establish compliance with federal requirements. This proposal adds all of these clarifying language to the statute in order to bring DHS into compliance with federal public law. And with that, I will turn it back over to Commissioner Hartstead.
Thank you. Chair Schultz, we just wanted to give you a little bit more information about the Blue Ribbon Commission strategies that are in the governor's budget. First is in the area of disability reforms, ensuring equitable access to HCBS waivers. The first would add an assessment to slow the growth of the fast-growing customized living unlicensed alternative to licensed care to be sure that that's being appropriately used across the state. And the second piece would adjust the family foster care rates. And the third would adjust historically underspent grants, actually discontinue historically underspent grants in the disability services area. The second proposal here on the page would, you saw the chart earlier in my introductory slides of how white people tend to end up in group homes while Black, Indigenous, and people of color in Minnesota tend to get PCA support. And we want to do a study to examine how that happens to be sure that our process is working equitably. The last here is fraud and abuse prevention measures. While there is not rampant fraud and abuse across human services in Minnesota, there is some. And the first here provides for third-party liability recoveries to develop training and informational materials for benefit recovery partners, making it easier for counties and tribes to investigate fraud. And the last piece would add to the investigative capacity of the Inspector General's office, where we have a track record of returning $4 in adjustments for every dollar that we spend in that department. There was just one other proposal we wanted you to know about. We've been asked, as all agencies of state government have been asked, to do an agency-wide operating adjustment, which adds up to less than 1.1% of our DHS budget and accounts for expected increases in a variety of administrative costs. And that is the end of our presentation, Chair Schultz. We are available for questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Okay, I just want to remind members, especially our new members, of how this process works. So this is the initial governor's budget proposal based on the November forecast, and there'll be another late February or early March forecast, and things could change. Especially, we don't know if we're going to get more federal assistance for COVID and for vaccination distribution. So things could change significantly between now and the next budget proposal. So just to keep members aware. And I see we have a few questions. Representative Fisher, please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. Appreciate the opportunity. And thank you, Commissioner Herbstadt, and to your staff for the presentations today. Questions are items that I've been looking at a little bit more was your presentation around behavioral health. And I want to say it's great that you've been taking a look at some agencies, areas that you can find savings to help make our machinery, our system more efficient. One of the questions I have is with the $14.3 million, are ways to invest that back into the system. And what I'm thinking of is that yesterday in the behavioral health division, we're hearing of the pending crisis that we're seeing in the behavioral health area, potential huge loss of hospital beds out there. The fact that sometimes people are waiting to come out of hospital beds because we don't have the system built out there. I know $14.3 million is not going to solve the problem at all, but say if we were to turn around to you and say, we've got an extra $14.3 billion, what do you think that you could do, your team could do to help start addressing the system out there, to start building out what we desperately need to address the needs of our Minnesotans who are experiencing behavioral health issues?
Commissioner Herbstadt?
Thank you, Chair Schultz and Representative Fisher. I'm going to ask Gertrude Mutembo-Mutasa if she had the opportunity to invest an additional $14 million in behavioral health, where she might imagine putting it.
Assistant Commissioner?
Yes, this is Gertrude Mutembo-Mutasa. Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. It's always easy to spend money, so I'm excited about this question. I can think of quite a few things, but right off the top of my head, I've got the pandemic right at the forefront of my brain right now. And so anything related to school-linked mental health is really, really big for me right now. And then in the same vein around kids as well, really more beds for kids who have severe mental illness. So really investing in our PRTFs would be really good. And then I'll just add one more, crisis services, really investing more in crisis services, and not just downstream crisis services, but more upstream. So how do we kind of create more holistic solutions instead of fishing people out of the river, so to speak? How are we investing more in families and those programs that involve families and educating families around mental health so that we can help kids and families as it relates to mental health? And I've got a bunch of other things too. So, but those would be the three that I would think are at the top of my head.
Thank you. Representative Fisher?
Oh, thank you for the suggestions. I appreciate it. It's one of the things that I feel it's very important that we take a look and start addressing the behavioral health area and working hard to build out the system. So I appreciate the thoughts and we'll look forward for more ideas as we go forward. Thank you.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Harpstead, good to see you again. I note in your slide number 6, that you note that if you don't reach out and speak to various interest groups, that all you'll hear from are the lobbyists, professional associations, and public relations groups that are more well-resourced. I'm surprised that you didn't include in that the two chambers of the legislative body, both the House and the Senate. Do they not, are they not considerate of who you might be talking to from such groups, as well as the rural, greater Minnesota population? So I'm going to move on to my first question, and you can dwell on that one. On slide 11, you mention about cost savings proposals that you have initiated. I'm wondering if you could describe what they are, and where do these proposals stand in terms of being implemented? And how will the legislature identify that those fiscal savings?
Commissioner Harpstead?
Yes, Chair Schultz and Representative Albright. The COVID pandemic has given me an unprecedented opportunity to be in constant communication with our four chairs of our Health and Human Services legislative committees. And so we've been having to talk about various waivers and changes to policy to get people through the pandemic. And then we've continued those conversations on a regular basis to begin to talk about potential proposals coming into the legislative session and other things that we need to discuss. So we talk with the four chairs at least probably every single week. And we have looked forward to the session where we have an opportunity to hear from all the rest of you about what you're thinking. And of course, you can contact us, and many people do throughout the year when they hear concerns and interest from constituents. So I was referring in that slide to listening to the community itself directly, but of course we are in constant communication with our legislative partners as well. I'm not quite sure what slide you're referring to when you talk about savings.
Let me just find it for you.
Was it page 11, Representative Albright?
Is it the Blue Ribbon Commission savings or the overall savings principle?
The savings principle on slide 10.
Right. And the specifics of those were in all of the assistant commissioner presentations that you saw. And I wonder if you could restate your question.
Well, I'll move on for the brevity of time, but my understanding is that you've already booked those savings in the current biennium. So I'm wondering in terms of from what base number you're looking for an increase from, if it's from the base prior to these savings, or if the savings reduce the base from which that you're requesting an increase.
Commissioner Harpstead?
Thank you, Chair Schultz and Representative Albright. I wonder, Matt Burdick, if you could put back up our final slide of the net spending and savings proposals.
Uh, Madam Chair, while Mr. Burdick is looking for that, I think what I understand then by my back of the envelope penciling out is that you're looking for $99 million in, above the base for all funds in 22-23, and in all funds above the base increase of $179 million in 24-25. If you could just get back to me on that. I'll leave my questioning for a further time, but I would like for you, Commissioner, or the various department heads to respond to two questions. It's come to my attention that in two particular instances, which are very alarming to me and the constituents I serve, that the governor's budget is suggesting a 47% reduction in ventilator reimbursement rates, which quite literally will force children to seek medical care in a hospital setting as opposed to in their home. I'm hoping that that is something that will be rethought entirely due to the fact of the nature of the care. But also I understand that the governor's budget also entirely eliminates any grant program for TBI SEI. I find that unconscionable in the nature of what these people are being successful at in terms of helping their own station in life. And I'm willing to believe that this is an oversight, and I hope it is. But if it's a proactive attempt to abandon and forsake these folks, I really hope that that you will be their champion. And I'm hoping that you can respond to both of those concerns on my part and the constituents that have called me out of great duress. And I'll leave it at that for right now, Madam Chair.
Commissioner Arpstead.
Thank you, Chair Schultz and Representative Albright. Dave Greenman, I wonder if you could check those numbers. Our budget director.
Director Greenman.
Yep, Madam Chair, thank you. This is Dave Greenman. I'm the budget director at DHS. I can certainly check those numbers, those assumptions. We'll have to probably get back to Representative Albright with our answer, but we're happy to look into those.
And Chair Schultz, if I could.
Go ahead, Commissioner Harpstead.
On this slide, you can see, I think you were referring to the Blue Ribbon Commission proposals already accounted for in the budget. That's the $61.3 million on the third line here, leaving a non-Blue Ribbon Commission savings proposals of 75.7. And then the overall general fund impact is a net investment of 105.5. We would be working to invest the TANF funds at $71.4 million and actually adding money back to the healthcare access fund to the tune of $2.8 million. And if we could answer your other two questions offline, I would like to get some more information about those and be able to give you some good specific information.
Thank you, Commissioner Harpstead. And I'm just going to add.
Madam Chair, I would just like to respond to that question about meeting.
Representative Albright, can you just hold on 1 second? I just want to interject. Thank you. I just want to say that I'm going to verify that Commissioner Harpstead has done a great job reaching out to me, and I know others, other chairs, to keep us updated. And we do have weekly meetings with the commissioner. So I wanted to verify what she said. But I also want to note that at least the Republicans in the Senate, I think their proposal was to cut 5% across the board, and that's an $800 million cut potentially to DHS. And so I know you're concerned, Representative Albright, and I appreciate that, but things could have been a lot worse if we followed what's being proposed in the Senate chamber. So go ahead, Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, to your point, I think it's, with all due respect, a distinction without definition to suggest that children who can't get a ventilator reimbursement at home now have to seek the care in a hospital, and that somehow is a better way of providing care to these, the most vulnerable amongst us, or another way to suggest that those that are suffering from a traumatic brain injury to somehow that the advances that they've made have no consequence going forward, and that the momentum that they have built over the last several years is all for naught. So Commissioner Harpstead, just a simple question, but do you support people with traumatic brain injury, and do you support children who need necessary services at home?
Representative Albright, you know, obviously we all do, and we don't have confirmation that those are the specific cuts. I think what the commissioner said and Director Greenman said is that they will get back to you to check to see and to verify. But do you want to respond, Commissioner Harpstead?
Yes, Chair Schultz and Representative Albright, simply that neither of those two elements are in our budget proposals, so I'm not quite sure where somebody's finding those in budget proposals. So I'm going to have to figure out where else they may be in state government in order to answer your question.
Thank you, Commissioner Albright. We're going to move on because we have a lot of questions here. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair Schultz, and thank you for the presentation today. I appreciate everybody just going into such detail with such intent and focus on the dignity and worth of the Minnesotans we serve. So I just wanted to recognize that and say thank you. I did have one question regarding substance use disorders. You had mentioned that there were some changes and savings, and I was just curious if you could tell me a little bit more about how these savings increase access to care. Thank you.
Commissioner Harpstead.
Chair Schultz, I wonder if Gertrude Mutemba-Mutasa could answer that question.
Assistant Commissioner.
Yes, Madam Chair and members. So the substance use reform package is really an investment. It's not really cuts. We're not viewing these as cuts. It's an investment first and foremost in quality programming, evidence-based, person-centered programming. And then the second piece that's an investment piece is when we enroll providers in the 1115 SUD waiver, we are able to pull down additional federal dollars. And those dollars are going to be invested directly into our state system to treat SUD treatment. The third piece, when providers are enrolled in this 1115 SUD waiver, they're eligible for two types of rate increases that go directly to the providers, a 15% increase for residential providers and a 10% increase for non-residential providers. So we're looking at this as really a win-win for the state as well as for people receiving the treatment. And that's why we're treating it as an investment overall.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Mutemba-Mutasa. Representative Hansen, do you have a follow-up question?
No, not at this time. And I apologize for if I use the words cuts. Still new, still getting used to this, so I appreciate it. And I just want to make sure that as we do these investments, that increasing access is at the forefront, of course, because we know that there's just some challenges accessing that. So I appreciate the answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, and all the assistant commissioners for your presentation today. It was very helpful. I wanted to go back to slide 11, which talked about the savings strategies. You talked about the $61.4 million that were from the Blue Ribbon Commission, and I wondered what percentage of that is tied to the state creating its own PBM, how much of that 61.4 comes from that? And secondly, there was a 38.6 that you just didn't feel were ready for prime time. And so if you could just sort of touch on what's in that bucket, and so we can be thinking about what that might look like in the future. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Harpstead?
Yes. Okay, so Chair Schultz and Representative, I don't have that slide with me today. We presented it yesterday to the Health Committee of the House, and I wonder if Dave Greenman could help me with the dollar amount associated with the three strategies using state purchasing power to reduce costs out of the Blue Ribbon Commission.
Director Greenman?
Madam Chair, Dave Greenman with the Department of Human Services. I believe the impact of the proposal on pharmacy produced a savings of fiscal year 22 and 23 of about $15 million. And that can, that also includes a dental element as well. So that those two are combined into one proposal. And I think, as Commissioner Harpstead mentioned, there's about 61 million in savings. So roughly 25% of the savings in the Blue Ribbon Commission package is in the dental and pharmacy proposal, if that's helpful.
Commissioner?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Representative Robbins, follow up.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. That was very helpful. And my second question was just on, you talked about payments for opioid treatments and changes that are in the payment methodologies. And I just wondered, could you specifically address if providers will still be receiving payments for just writing a prescription and the person takes the medication at home? Will they still be paid for that? Thank you.
And once again, I would turn to Gertrude Matemba-Matassa.
So this is an issue that we've been working on as a team to really provide guidance and clarification. And in the past, we have spoken too soon on these issues. And so right now we're in the process of developing the guidance that should be issued here within the next month or so as to, you know, how much can somebody take home and when and what's required. As many of you know, this generated quite a few headlines for us in 2019, and we went back to the drawing board and decided that we were just going to do it right. And so we had a work group working on this very issue, and the guidance should be coming out pretty soon.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Matemba-Matassa. Representative Robbins, did you have any more follow-up questions? Otherwise, I'm going to move on and we can get back to you.
Thank you. Yes, I would just like to be kept updated on your final guidance on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Noor.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members and Commissioner for the presentation on the budget recommendations. My quick question number one is on the SNAP error rate, which was 9.78%, and that didn't look too good, just to avoid fines. Is there any proposal to change categorical eligible recipients so that we can avoid long-term? Is there a proposal coming from the department?
Commissioner Harpstead?
Chair Schultz and Representative Noor, this is a continuous process of improvement, working with our county partners to be sure that SNAP decisions are made accurately and appropriately. And the additional dollars to invest in the SNAP error rate improvement would be additional time, people, to make sure that we are working with all of our partners to get these SNAP decisions made accurately. And so we continue to do that on an ongoing basis, and we need to invest more to get this done as soon as possible. Of course, COVID changed all kinds of things about SNAP. And so we're also working continuously with the USDA to see if there's going to be any relief on getting these error rates in order in the same time frame, given the interruption that COVID caused to so many of these benefits.
Thank you, Commissioner Madam Chair, Representative
Noor. My question was in regards to recipients who are considered categorically eligible so that we can address the long-term impact on the error rates. Right now, I believe the state is at 165% for those individuals. If we increase, it may reduce some of the burden to the workers and everybody else. And also, if we can expand some of the requirement under that category, will there be any plan coming from the department to address that issue?
Commissioner?
Chair Schultz and Representative Noor, I would turn to Lisa Bailey for an answer to that question.
Assistant Commissioner Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Noor, In the current proposal, we do not include a broad-based categorical eligibility change, but it is something that probably would impact errors, and it's something that staff would be willing to look at. The proposal itself addresses more working with staff on training and some necessary systems changes that we believe will have go a long way towards addressing those errors. But we're willing to look at that and consider something for the future.
Representative Noor.
Madam Chair, it will be great if we can have a look at some of those elements that will reduce significantly some of the challenges we face with SNAP errors so that we don't get fined and we can be able to serve more people. My second quick question is you, Commissioner, you indicated there'll be almost $74 million from the TANF Reserve Fund. How much of that will be spent on workforce development?
Commissioner Harpstead?
Yes, Chair Schultz. Representative Noor, I didn't hear the last couple words of your question. How much would be spent?
On workforce development so that we can help those who have been impacted by COVID-19 pandemic and we can help them with upskilling, giving them new training so that they can get back to work quickly and even better than before the COVID-19 pandemic.
Commissioner?
Chair Schultz and Lisa Bailey, I would ask you to repeat the dollar amount that would be invested in the uniformity of benefits, which is exactly that, an investment in workforce development.
Assistant Commissioner Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Noor, I believe that number is $78.7 million in the next biennium. I'm sorry, that's the total amount. The for the cash assistance simplification, it's $19.1 million in one-time TANF reserve funds.
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Also, I will follow up with the department in regards to the reforms on the background check, you know, checks that we have, because it gives many people trouble because of minor issues which we could have addressed. So I'm hoping that the review done on the background checks will be provided to us so we can take a look in how to reform that process. So thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you for that question. Representative Pearson. I believe you're muted. We are having problems hearing you, Representative Pearson. I'm going to go to the next one and maybe you can reconnect. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is prompted by, I guess, the exchange with Representative Albright earlier. I don't know the specifics of that particular issue, but it was just, I guess I was thinking about the commissioner's comment about difficult policy choices needing to be made with targets. And I guess I just want to observe for all of us that the department does tremendous work supporting vulnerable people, as Representative Albright referenced, and we all want to support that too. And I believe, as the commissioner said, that the people of Minnesota want that at a personal level. And the way that we do that is through the revenues that the government brings in, and then we have that spending. I feel like we saw that in the comment from Ms. Matusa as well, in terms of saying, boy, if I had more money, I could spend on schooling mental health grants. So I guess I just hope that as we each are pointing out the areas that we want to make sure the department is acting in, that we are going to be supporting the revenues that are necessary, because if we want to make sure that there's money to spend on vulnerable people, we need to make sure that that those folks who've been fortunate that we're going to have the tax revenues to do that. So really just a comment in that way is prompted by that. I just worry sometimes we focus a lot on bashing that piece and need to recognize that there's the other side of the ledger as well. So I hope that we all will support the revenue that's necessary to make the kind of investments that our department is making and needs to do even more of. Just a comment on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Representative Sandel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Commissioner. Early in the presentation, you presented a couple of slides, graphs showing access to programs from ethnic groups. I wonder if you have a graph like that, which breaks down access to programs from urban and rural Minnesota.
Commissioner?
Yes, Chair Schultz and Representative Sandel. I didn't bring that with me today, but I do have such a thing. I noted recently when we did the state of Minnesota by county, the distribution of our public health care benefit is almost exactly the same as the distribution of the population across the state of Minnesota by county. There's only a slight difference when we start to look at the SNAP benefits, a little more urban than rural, and when we look at the MFIT benefits, a little more urban than rural, but just by a few percentage points.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Sandel.
Oh, I'm sorry. Pardon me, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. If you do have a chance of sending that along, that would be terrific. Thank you.
Let's try Representative Pearson again. Can you try your question again, Representative Pearson? I'm not able to hear you. I don't think others are either. Sounds like you have a bad connection, Representative Pearson. You might want to log out and try logging in again, and we'll get back to you. Really sorry about the technology problem. Let's see. Go to Representative Keel, please.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm back when you were talking about moving, Commissioner Harbstead, when you're talking about moving the waiver services from four categories to two, are you going to be presenting us with detailed plans on that? I'm curious as to how all of those are going to manage the detail and then the funding that, how are you saving any money on that because you're not changing numbers?
Commissioner Harbstead?
Yes, Chair Schultz and Representative Keel. The Waiver Reimagine project has been going on for several years and has been very much in collaboration with the provider sector and advocates. And again, Gertrude Matembo Matasa, I wonder if you could make a comment about savings that would occur from fewer waivers.
Assistant Commissioner Matembo Matasa, please proceed.
Madam Chair and members, I don't have the details right now in terms of how we would realize the savings, but we would be happy to provide that after this meeting. But we do know that there is an initial cost of $1.7 million in the 22-23 biennium, and thereafter savings of $7.4 million. I would speculate it's probably due to efficiencies, but I would prefer to give you specifics, which we're happy to do after this meeting.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Representative Keel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to see the detail on that. I get a little concerned about how we're shifting that and are we really saving funds on that? So thanks.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for Commissioner Harbstead. Commissioner Harbstead, if this committee or the legislature more broadly decided that we couldn't fully fund the governor's budget request for DHS and its programs, where would you recommend we first look for savings relative to the governor's current proposal?
Commissioner Harbstead?
Yes, Chair Schultz and Representative Rasmussen. I have not thought about that, and I would really hesitate to give you an answer off the top of my head. I would have to examine that further to think about what our next steps would be. So, sorry, I can't answer that just right now, but I'll give that some thought.
I mean, there are savings in the proposal, Representative Rasmussen, so I would look at those first in those detailed budget sheets you've received. I don't know if you've had time to look through all of those, but things could change, and the commissioner will be back in the next round of the budget with the new forecast. Do you have a follow-up question, Representative Rasmussen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. No follow-up questions, but would appreciate as we kind of continue to look at budgets and budget proposals. I think it's likely that we won't be able to fund the full ask that the governor has put out, and so it'd be very helpful to have guidance from the department and its leadership on where they would recommend looking first as we just try to prioritize taxpayer dollars across the budget. But I appreciate the commissioner and her work here today. And so thank you for your time.
Thank you. Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is for Commissioner Harpstedt. Thank you for being here. As a farmer and a self-employed farmer up in Minnesota, in northwestern Minnesota, for years we were spending $200 to $2,500 a month on premiums for insurance, and with deductibles upwards of $6,000 per individual. So self-employed folks really struggled. And I'm not sure if this question is pertinent to this setting right now, but I'm just curious why the governor pulled all the money out of the reinsurance program, which helped stabilize those costs. Could you answer that for me?
Commissioner Harpstedt?
Yes, Chair Schultz and Representative Burkle. I'm sorry, I'm not an expert in reinsurance. I've heard some of the conversation sitting in meetings, but I really am not the person to answer that question. That's been more of a question from our Commerce Department and our Healthcare Administration, who is not here today to answer that question, but we will try to get back to you with that.
But also, this would be a question for Chair Liebling's committee. So, I'm sure we will be speaking a lot about reinsurance this session, and I am happy to talk with you offline, Representative Burkle, about reinsurance and the history of it, and Commerce will be talking about reinsurance, and I know there will likely be a bill. Chair Liebling may want to respond to that question. Go ahead, Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. That's why I raised my hand, just to respond to this quickly. And just to say to Representative Burkle, this will be a big topic because, honestly, everyone recognizes the problem, that there's a huge problem, the problem that you're identifying. And it is definitely an interest of all of ours to make sure that everybody can get coverage at an affordable rate. And we recognize that having coverage like you described is essentially having no coverage.
Exactly.
And so, you know, I appreciate your raising the issue. We will be wrestling with this. The question, I think, is whether the reinsurance program is the best way to handle this for the money that's invested. So, you know, obviously it's a discussion for another time. And Chair Schultz actually is, you know, had a bill in the other committee just yesterday, I think, another way to address it. And this will be a big topic for the session. So appreciate your interest in it, and to be continued. Thank you.
Yes, I will share House File 11 with you, Representative Burkle. It's the Minnesota Care Public Option, which is an affordable way to get coverage, especially for farmers. Let's see. We have time for maybe one more short question. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. The question is for Commissioner Harstead. Commissioner Harstead, you had a slide where you mentioned that Minnesota is almost at the bottom for racial equity. What were the matrix that you were used to come up with that measurement? And then, you know, which states are lower and which states are best?
Commissioner Harpstedt.
Yes, thank you, Chair Schultz and Representative Novotny. The data that I remember the best is out of the Compass report that was done several years ago and publicized across Minnesota. And as I recall, Mississippi was the only state lower ranked than Minnesota. And all the other states fared better in that report. And so it looked at average income and educational attainment and a whole variety of factors to make that determination.
Would it be
Representative Otney?
Thank you, Chair. Sorry. Commissioner Harpta, would it be possible to get those parameters and see what those were and see where we can work on things?
Commissioner?
Chair Schultz and Representative Novotny, absolutely. Yes, we can make that available again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for all the questions. Thank you, Commissioner, and all your entire team for presenting the budget. We look forward to more follow-up, especially with the questions that we were not able to answer during committee hearings. We know there's a lot of work that goes into putting these budget proposals together. We appreciate being briefed today. So members, next Tuesday, our next committee hearing, we are going to start hearing our first set of bills. So look for the next email from Ying Yang Vang with the agenda and with the bills. And remember that we now have rules for the committee and we have a 24-hour amendment rule. So looking forward to seeing everyone next Tuesday. We stand adjourned. Thank you.